Session number 6229, reel 3.
Mrs. Colley, reel 3. You were saying, Mrs. Colley, that the Japanese at Muntok seemed to leave you to largely organize yourselves.
Yes.
What did the Japanese administration consist of in terms of hierarchy and numbers of personnel?
No idea. We didn't seem to meet up with them very much. When we went to the next move, there seemed to be officers floating around, and they asked us all. We had to fill in particulars of who we were. This was when we got to Palembang. They didn't seem to start organising us until we got to Palembang.
Can we just stick to Muntok?
You want to
moment.
Get to Muntok?
Yes,
no, I can't remember that we saw very much of them at all. And in the way of officers, I suppose some of them walked through occasionally, but even then, we were inclined to ignore them as much as possible. Unless they actually came up to us personally, we would try to pretend they weren't there. I think we had that attitude of rather closing our eyes to them. But I couldn't tell you. I have no idea, no recollection at all. I'd say we're probably still in the state of numbness, not taking any interest. I don't know. I don't think we would have bothered anyhow. I don't think we were interested in them.
So the Japanese played little part in the running of the camp?
Oh, no, none at all. There was a senior officer among the men, I suppose, who sort of suggested that somebody had to get cracking with the cooking for such a large number, and some men volunteered to do that, and the camp just sort of started running itself, and apart from the fact the Japs must have put in the rice and stuff for us, but apart from that, they didn't seem to take any interest in us at all. I should imagine that they'd got enough to do their clearing up and doing various things. They probably, having put us into this place where we at least were guarded and we couldn't escape, that they left us to pursue other things, because I expect they had plenty to do.
As far as you were concerned, the internees, how did you then organise yourselves to deal with the routine needs of the day?
Well, in that camp, we didn't really do much at all, except, as I say, the main thing was the cooking that had to be done. We'd been pushed into these dormitories, and we seemed to just stay there. But nobody I can remember, can't remember anybody particularly bothering to move to any other place. And somebody produced a pack of cards, and those people who were bridge fiends seemed to start and settle down to play bridge all day. And I said, oh, the rest of us, we wandered about, my friend and I. We just walked up and down, keeping exercised as much as we could. We just walked up and down under this roof. People sat around and talked. There was nothing much we could do. And there was that we didn't know how long we were going to be there. And, nothing at that time seemed to be organized. We just, as I said, when the food was ready, they called us, whoever was preparing it, we queued up. Very, as English people always do, we queued up and stood in a queue for ages and ages and ages for our food, and that took half the day because we had two meals a day, and the queuing took quite a long time, something to do. And, I very, very hazy recollection of that whole fortnight there.
Do you remember how the food was organised?
Well, just that they brought it in, I don't know, whether in buckets or some containers, and dished it out to us. I had a billy can that I'd acquired on the ship. I certainly didn't bring it with me, but among the things I acquired was a billy can, and I think I must have, yes, I used that. And on the ship, before we left, on the Matahari, there was a girl there who'd recently married, and she'd got a canteen of silver cutlery that had been a wedding present. She'd managed to get onto the ship. She was expecting to take it home. Of course, when we were taken and the Japs were aboard, she threw open this canteen of cutlery and told us to help ourselves. By the time I got there, there wasn't much left, but I took a tablespoon. And that was very good because I was able to have something to use to eat. And people took, well, what they could from this canteen, a beautiful silver cutlery with her initials on them.
Yes, you were at Muntok in the Chinese, in the Coolie Lines, from the 16th of February to the 2nd of March 1942, so about 3 weeks, something like that. Were you not there long enough for any real routine to develop?
No, there was no, except the meal times. We just had the meals twice a day. And that was all. We, as I say, that was the main organisation, the meals, and there was nothing organised.
Yes. Apart from the cooking, was there any work which had to be done by the internees?
No, except we kept our own huts clean, and of course the what passed as toilets had to be cleaned, which were only drains, just cemented drains, and they had to be swilled down and swept. I think must have been some stiff sort of witch's broom type, birch broom things. They had to be kept clean, but apart from that and keeping our own places clean, there wasn't very much that we could do there. I think some people did a bit of washing. There was some water in a tap. We just washed whatever we could.
Yes. And the cleaning of the dormitories that we're using, was this done in any formal kind of way, with a rota or anything?
No, not at all. Somebody who felt like it would do it. I don't think it wasn't. I can't remember any organisation at all.
Yes. The 2 meals a day you had, they were probably the feature of the day.
Absolutely, yes. Highlights of the day, although when I got it, I didn't eat it, but that wasn't the point. It was it was something going on.
Yes.
And this long queue that took ages and ages, and then a bit of amusement looking at what you'd got to see what could have possibly been in it, because apparently they'd got some tins of bully beef and some tins of jam and tins of fish, and whatever the cooks felt like stirring into this rice would go in. And it was quite amusing trying to trace what might have been put in originally, because you sometimes found a bit of discoloration that could have been made by jam, and sometimes you found a fish bone, so probably it had been fish that time, and a shred of corned beef, which meant that some corned beef might have gone in. But I mean, there's really nothing recognisable in this rice, but it was, of course, sort of quite an amusement trying to find out what had gone into it. And it was filthy rice anyhow, and I personally couldn't eat. I just ate about 2 tablespoonfuls each meal, until it got to such a state I didn't realise it at the time, as one doesn't. But towards the end of the time, I was just sleeping all the time, and I would get up in the in the morning and sort of drag myself around and go back and go to sleep and eat these 2 tablespoonfuls of rice and go to sleep again. Of course, I didn't realise, but I suppose I was just underfed. I wasn't eating enough. Some of them managed to eat it, and they could eat as many as they could get, 2 or 3 bowls full, or eat the peoples who wouldn't eat. But I couldn't face it, and I was just almost starving myself, and I didn't realise this, but it affected me by making me just sleep all the time. So by the end of the time, I was spending most of the time asleep, so weak, I suppose, that I'm obviously not getting enough to sustain me and keep me awake, which was quite a good way to pass the time anyhow.
Were there any serious health problems arising from lack of food or for any other reason at this time?
Well, not there, because it was a bit early, early stages. I don't think anybody particularly suffered. I can't remember anybody particularly having any effect on anybody. I don't remember. Maybe. I can't remember. Oh, it had been going on for a long time, and I think that we were all pretty affected by it. And then the people who'd been in the water, they were only too thankful to be out of the water, and they were trying to recover from that. There was really get over that and start wanting. I don't think people wanted to do anything. I think they were all in a state of stupor, really, a semi-stupor anyhow.
Sounds a bit as if you were all waiting for something to happen.
Yes, I think we were, because we'd no idea how long we were. See, if you ask that, well, I think somebody, you know, tried to get out of the Japs. They saw how long. Nobody knew anything. Nobody could tell us anything. Mm. And so we just didn't know. We couldn't foresee what was ahead of us.
Have you any idea whether before your capture, the captain of the ship had managed to get off any radio messages to Singapore about what was happening?
No, I don't know. But then Singapore fell so soon that it wouldn't have made any difference, would it, do you see? Because we were taken on the Friday, Singapore fell on the Sunday. So, you know, we were taken on the Saturday, and Singapore fell on the Sunday. So had he done so, they wouldn't have made any difference. Mm. There wouldn't have been any records or left or anything. I don't know. I shouldn't think so. He may have radioed what conditions were like, but whether he did or not, I have no idea.
So after 2 weeks or so at Muntauk, you got your first move. Did you know in advance?
Well,
by very much?
They just told us the day before that we were going the next day and to take only what we could carry only again. And we were trying to reorganize myself so that I could carry things a bit more conveniently. And people produced all sorts of things that they weren't going to carry. One Australian sister, for instance, how on earth she happened upon it, I don't know. She produced a bottle of cherry brandy, and she said she wasn't going to carry this. So I always remember she poured this out, and I drank cherry brandy out of an enamel mug. And by the time it was time to go, I couldn't care less, you know. It was lovely, not especially as I hadn't had anything, practically nothing to eat for a fortnight, and I was easily overcome by this cherry brandy. And but it didn't taste the same out of an enamel mug. Oh, dear. So she got rid of her bottle. And, you know, this is what people do. They turned out even things that they felt they couldn't carry, and because we didn't know whether we were going to have another trail and carry things for miles.
What were you informed of when you were told you were going to move?
Nothing, just that we were going to another camp where it would be better. It was always going to be better wherever we went. I mean, whatever the conditions were when we arrived, it was always going to be better. That was all.
How was the information about the move given?
I don't know. I have no idea who got it first. They probably told the men first, and the men told us, as far as I can remember. I can't remember. Nobody was officially designated then as being, you know, in command or to be the spokesman or spokeswoman. I really can't remember.
What did you do by way of preparing for this move?
Well, they just repacked things in the way that was a bit easier to transport, and that seemed to be the only thing we could do.
And what do you remember of the move itself?
Well, we were packed onto this boat. We were on deck, and it was only a small boat, and we just sat around there because it was terribly hot. And I had, fortunately, one of the things I'd put in my bag was a towel. And eventually, I remember sitting hooded in this towel over my head and shoulders because the sun was so, I mean, it was terrific to be exposed in those temperatures, terribly, terribly hot. And we were just sitting close together, some on the deck, some sort of perched up on whatever it is of a deck. And the Japs then, a lot of the soldiery came round, and they were trying to get people to take off their jewellery and give them, and they were being a bit unpleasant. And a lot of the people did. They took rings off their fingers. They were so frightened that they were handing over rings, which, of course, they were trying to get. And brooches and so on, anything that they could see people were wearing. But the soldiers at that time, you see, seemed a bit out of control. They didn't seem to have anybody to stop them, because I know later on when we reported things like that, the officers, were annoyed to think that they had done this. But it was just a question of them not being supervised enough, and they were going to get what they could while they could. But they did frighten quite a lot of people. And I seem to remember is this terrific heat and trying to endure it, just hunched up in a towel and tucking my hands away so they wouldn't see any rings that I'd got, and just taking no notice when they went along. Because, of course, it was foolish. Some people were just sitting, with their hands exposed, and they could so easily, if they'd realised, if they saw the Japs doing that further up the road, they should have taken some action. But a lot of them lost their rings because they weren't fast enough to either covering themselves up or taking their rings off. And I just huddled and endured, and it must have been evening by the time, so it was practically all day, and I don't remember getting anything to eat. We might have done, but I can't remember getting anything to eat.
And were you told where you were going?
No, I don't think so. I think somebody who knew the area realised that we were going to Palembang, I don't think they told us. They just said we were going somewhere where we'd be better for us.
And this better place, what did it turn out to be?
Well, of course, first it was evening, as I say, and we were taken to a school, first of all, and we were given food there because they'd taken some of the men off first. Because obviously we weren't all on this one little ship. They must have taken some of the men off first, and some of the men there, or some men who'd already been there interned, and they got a meal ready for us. And that was about the first decent meal we'd had. It was only soup and a sort of stew, but it had got some trace of meat in it, and it tasted absolutely marvellous to us. And then we just had to bed down in the classrooms of this school, and I know there were about 40-odd of us in the classroom where I was, and absolutely beset with mosquitoes. Eventually the guard turned the light on and left us in the light all night, because at least when it was night, light, the mosquitoes weren't so bad. Directly the light was turned out, the mosquitoes dived on us. And that was a pretty grim night, because we were packed there in the heat, in the, as I say, 40-odd in a small classroom. And then the next day we were taken out and put into these small houses that had been occupied by the Dutch people. And they were just small houses, about three or four rooms. Empty.
Yes. What number of these sort of places were there, and what area were they in?
Oh, well, it was just like a small road. I think there might have been 20 or less than 20 houses. It was just a small road that they'd obviously taken over and stripped, and just put us in these empty houses. And it was just a small, well, I think I think it went round a corner there. Anyway, it was a very small place. There weren't many houses.
Now, when you first moved into the houses at Palembang, what were conditions like for you there?
Well, they were just empty houses. There was a few bits of furniture. Some of them had more furniture than others. Obviously, they'd been just left as the Dutch were taken away, and probably vandalised by the local population, who'd stripped them of most of the things. But there were a few things left behind, nothing of very great use, no beds or anything like that. Some of them had odd chairs. I think somebody had an electric cooker even, and but various oddments. It just depended by sheer luck which house you went into and what was there. In ours, we seemed to have piles of rubbish, and books seemed to be the only thing we found. They were very dirty, but piles of books, which we pounced on, because quite a number of them were English books, and all sorts of rubbish, some of which was useful, but most of it we had to clear out. But there wasn't any in the one we went to personally. There wasn't a great deal of anything useful for us. But it was a house with a roof, and as I've said, that it was a relief to get away from this awful shed in Muntoc with its galvanised roof, and to be able to see the sky above us, because when we went outside, we could see the sky, which was wonderful, because we'd been under this roof for over a fortnight in Muntoc, and so to be in a place where we could actually walk out of the door into the road and see the sky seemed to be a great step in the right direction.
How did the Japanese assign these houses to you?
Well, it was just chance. We just lined up in a long queue, and it was, you and you in there pushed us in willy-nilly, really. Some of us managed to dodge about, and if we thought we liked the look of some one set or anybody we happened to have got to know in that time, we tried to change over and get with them, but it was just a arbitrary arrangement. And at that time, they had kept the servicemen when we left Muntoc. They divided us up when we left Muntoc and kept the servicemen apart. We didn't know what happened to them, although, of course, they must have been brought over eventually to Plembang and put into camps for military personnel. But we had the civilian men still with us. There were some elderly men and various, not many, but just a few husbands of some of the wives who were there. And they were with us. And we really were quite pleased about that. It seemed that, it was some sort of help to us to feel that there were a few men about. And we had one man in our camp, an elderly man who suffered from diabetes, although, poor thing, he didn't have any treatment with him, of course, and the food did him no good with diabetes. And we just settled down thinking that it was so much better after Muntoc, cleared the place up. And there were some Dutch people there, not many, but there were some Dutch people there. And they'd got food that we hadn't, because we'd just come with what we could carry. And they had some food, even bread and butter and tins of stuff. And they were very kind. They the ones that we met, anyhow, shared with us what they had. Mm. And so we really thought things were a bit brighter at that time. And we didn't do much in the way of organisation, because there wasn't really nothing much we could do. They brought in the rations and we, divided them up. Mm. And we just lived thinking that probably we were going to be housed like that for the rest of the time.
How many of you were together in the house?
I can't remember this first house. I think it was probably about 20 odd. I should think it was probably 20, I should think, easily. I can't really remember. I remember better the second lot, because we were there for longer. But that first group of houses, I don't really remember very much how many there were. There was certainly the nucleus of the people we formed for the next group. So there were about 12 of the group that we eventually finished up with in the next lot of houses. And then 15, yes, I should think 20 was about the number that we had.
That sounds a lot of people for a small house.
Well, it was, especially for the toilet facilities. You can imagine these houses were only obviously built for the occupation of a very small family. I think the one we were in had only one bedroom, just one bedroom, a through sitting room, and it was very small. They were very small houses. And we just had the roadway to walk in. We were only allowed to walk along the road and round the corner, which was also occupied by our people. And that was the limit, but we could walk up and down with very little interference.
How did you organise the small amount of space that was available to you for sleeping and living and cooking and things?
Well, we just bedded down. I think I think there were about eight, probably 10 of us in the bedroom, as far as I can remember. But after the 40 in the school classroom, we thought even that was better, because it seemed very much more space than we had in that classroom. And of course it was preferable, although we were still lying on tiles, because the floors were tiled for coolness, of course. and they were pretty hard, but it was better than the sort of fish slabs we'd had in Muntop, which were sloping. And I wrote in my diary that it was a joy to be flat instead of trying to get comfortable on a slope. And so we really thought that it felt better. But of course, lying on tiles is far from a good thing to do. The friend I had, who I'd known before in Singapore, I only met her by chance. I didn't know she was still in Singapore. And we kept together. And we had just a travelling rug on which we lay. And she had one and I had one, so we put one under us and had one to cover us. And we used our Mae Wests, which we'd brought off the ship, as pillows. And but it's pretty thin to lie on tile floor.
Was there much by way of furniture in this little house?
No, particularly in the one we were in, there wasn't. Some people had an odd chair. Some of them had chairs with cushions in, which came in very useful later on, because when we moved, they took the cushions with them. They couldn't take the chairs with them, but they did at least take the cushions on which some people could sleep, which was a bit better. The deep chair cushions, seat cushions and so on. And one house, as I say, had an electric cooker, which of course was marvellous, but that didn't... ours, I can't remember that we had. We just cooked out at the back, made a brick fire. We found a few odd bricks and put that out, and they gave us some wood, which we had to chop. And I don't know where we'd got pots from. Maybe there were some pots, I don't remember. But anyway, we cooked on these just over a little open wood fire at the back of the premises.
I believe you weren't in this accommodation for a very long period.
No, it was April the 1st, which now we left Muntok when about the 28th, I think, of February. And then on April the 1st, we were all called out. Bring what we could carry only. And we dreaded this because we thought we were quite reasonably settled there, and we didn't know what was going to happen then. And they just assembled us on a parade ground with what we could carry only. They searched our baggage for knives and scissors and razor blades for some reason. We thought we were going to commit mass suicide or something. They were very anxious to collect anything that would cut. Looking back on it, I don't know whether this was for their own use or not. And they saw us as a possible source of supply. I really don't know, or whether they, as I say, they managed, imagined we were going to commit suicide. But anyway, they did. And I know I had some razor blades, which I surrendered, but I did keep my nail scissors and a penknife. I just hoped for the best that they wouldn't search too thoroughly and find those. But a lot of people gave up everything that they had that was sharp, and of course very regretfully afterwards, because they could have used these sort of things we needed so badly all the time we were there. So goodness knows, I can't tell you why they did it, but they did. They raged up and down demanding these things. And then the men were separated then. They took out all the civilian men. And from then on, it was purely women and children. And thinking that perhaps we were going on a long journey, we were not looking forward to it. But after standing for hours in the sun, they marched us off to some other houses. And that was all that we found, that instead of going back to the same houses, they took us to another set of houses, round which they had erected this time barbed wire. So they'd obviously prepared this little set of houses. There were 18 small houses, and they'd obviously prepared these specially. It was probably a better place for them to be able to encompass us with barbed wire. And so then they marched us in, and again we just had to settle in as best we could. And there were 18 houses and two garages in use. Remember any more garages that were used, but anyway, they were two garages that could be used, And the party I was with, 15 of us, were allocated to the garage. And by that time, too, there were added some more people, some more Dutch people joined us. They'd obviously rounded up some more Dutch people by that time, because originally in the first lot of houses, we were only the people who'd come off the ships and they'd taken on our way from Muntok. But now we were joined by more Dutch people. And probably one of the reasons why they changed the accommodation. And we were given, our British party was given this garage, 15 of us, and the house was given to the Dutch people. And there were about, there were about 20 or so of them and 15 of us in what was just a very small house, one bedroom, one sitting room, one toilet and a shower, and us in the garage, and we were all there, over 30 of us, to use just the facilities that there were. So we were more crowded, really.
It sounds as if you got a bad deal getting the garage.
Well, yes, except the only thing good about it, well, I don't know, maybe there was more good about it, but one thing that was very good about it was that the Dutch people who were in the house to which the garage was attached were very, very kind to us. They were very good. They had only just been brought into the camp, and they had been able to bring quite a lot of stuff with them, and they had quite a lot in the way of provisions and so on, and they were very kind, and they did help us out, and they did share quite a lot of things with us that we shouldn't have had otherwise, and that some of the other people were not fortunate enough to get. So we did, there was a bright side to it.
Mm-hmm.